This is Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel. Race and Jews, Part 5. The last time I talked about Richard Dawkins and a twit that he had sent out, and this week it's Amanda Bynes. Amanda Bynes is a young half-Jew celebrity with mental health issues, and she's got 3.5 million followers compared to Richard Dawkins' mere 1 million. Amanda is unstable and really hasn't sent very many tweets over the past few months. She's had other things to worry about. But today, earlier today, and I'm recording this on Monday, she tweeted, "Adolf Hitler tricked the Germans into believing that Jews were less than the Germans and that they should be segregated and then killed." And that was retweeted 4,000 times. I think this is important not because Amanda Bynes herself is important. She's kind of a symptom of one of many of what's wrong with our society today. But the point, I think, is the pervasiveness of the Jewish narrative, which is what she's parroting here. In fact, if she causes any controversy at all with this and what I've seen so far, it's that she seems too forgiving of the Germans, not harsh enough toward the Germans. But this really goes to the pervasiveness of the Jewish narrative. The Germans and the Jews are distinct, and even the Jewish narrative spells that out in painting the Jews as victims purely, and the Germans as their victimizers. Hitler and the National Socialists offered German leadership to the Germans. They didn't trick the Germans. They offered them what they wanted because they resented being ruled and harmed by Jews, and they wanted an end to it. It's Jews who have always thought less of the Goyim, the non-Jews. How many Germans were killed before World War II? How many Germans were killed during World War II? How many whites have been killed by whites who have been tricked into war by the Jews? The Jews don't care how many whites have died. All they care about is how many Jews have died, how many Jews have suffered. And that's all they want anyone else to care about. Another item this week that is also connected to what I talked about the last time is about that poll that I've mentioned, and I continue to harp on because I think it's very important. About a year ago, Pew released the results of a poll of Jews that had some very interesting things to say. Well, this article I'll link this week and talk a little bit about here is written by J.J. Goldberg in the Jewish Daily Forward, and he's discussing a reanalysis by two other Jews of the data that was gathered in that poll last year. And it's really just Hasbara, or Jews trying to explain the results of the poll. The results of the poll from a white point of view is that the Jews see themselves as Jews, as a separate group. They're obsessed about their own interests as Jews. They're worried, and all of the headlines in the, to the extent the mainstream media, mainstream Jewish media covered the poll, was that the sky was falling for the Jews. And it turns out the reality is that it's really only the more secular, assimilated Jews, the more liberal Jews that are not replacing themselves. And that's what J.J. Goldberg talks about here. He says that this report, this reanalysis, focuses mainly on worrisome family patterns in, of non-Orthodox Jews. Fewer marry, those who marry have fewer children, and those with children give them less Jewish education. And this is the important one, the important point about this. The likely result, the signs are already visible, is that each successively younger age cohort is smaller than the one before, less Jewishly attached, and less likely to, in turn, to give their children a strong sense of Jewish identity. So they're talking here specifically about their identity as Jews, as a member of that group. And there's really, it's much ado about nothing, as most Jewish whining about how much they're suffering usually is. It's an exaggeration of their suffering, because the Orthodox Jews, the ones who strongly identify as Jews, who literally wear it on their sleeves that they're Jews, are doing just fine. In fact, they're booming. Their population is booming. Their birth rates are well above replacement, and they're growing. On the other side, on the non-Orthodox, these Jews who marry out and stop being Jews, well, they melt into the white population. They turn into people like Amanda Bynes and many other horrible examples. And then whites get the blame for their behavior. A little later on, Goldberg writes, "If Pew tells us anything, it is this: judged by their ability to retain the allegiance of their young, foster a commitment to a group, the group life of Jews at home and abroad, or even meet the elementary needs of survival American Jews, whatever stories they continue to tell about themselves no longer constitute a great community." The solution that they suggest, these two Jews who did this reanalysis, first of all, get more kids into Jewish day schools, which are depicted as the one sure fix for dissolving Jewish identity. I think this is an important point here, because it's really stating the obvious. Education is important. Who's teaching your kids and what are they teaching them is important. In the case of Jews, they have schools that are dedicated to teaching Jews how to be Jews, how to think of themselves as Jews. They teach their kids who they are, who their enemies are. They teach them to think of themselves as part of a group, to be loyal and committed to that group. And this is one of the results of that Pew poll. If Pew tells us anything, it's that Jews are obsessed with their identity and their interests, and at the center of that is number one on their list of what's essential to being Jewish is remembering the Holocaust, which is really just the latest form of thinking of themselves as victims. The eternal victims. And who are they victims of? They're victims of whites. And Goldberg comes clean and, of course, makes it clear that this doomsday, this demise of the title of his article, I don't think I actually read this, more dire signs of liberal Jewry's demise. He qualifies it clearly and talks about how the Orthodox are doing just fine. How fast are they growing? Consider Orthodox Jews comprise about 11% of the total American Jewish population of about 6 million, but they're 27% of the 1 million children under 18. In New York City, that figure is 60%. And nearly all that growth is in the black-hatted Hasidic and Yeshivist communities, not the modern Orthodox. It's all about the birth rates. They're having lots and lots of babies, as well as being very, very emphatic on their education, the education of their children as Jews. Goldberg concludes his article by writing, "Judaism probably isn't at risk, but the worldly liberal Jewry that emerged from the Enlightenment could be." So that's the real story behind the Sky is Falling headlines that came out when the poll came out. it's really only one half of Jewry that's at risk. And even that's not really at risk. It's, first of all, they're not taking all of the rest of Jewry with them. They're taking down whites, really. And they're spending their money and spending their time and their energy keeping the world safe for the rest of Jewry, keeping the world safe for Israel, lobbying in white countries to send the money of whites and the white soldiers overseas to die, to protect that more Jewy, more fecund core of Jewry, which will continue to spore, by the way, spawn more worldly liberal Jewry. It just is constantly throwing off secularized Jews who take off the black hat and the black coat and pretend to be white, as they always have. Now, it's one of those coincidences. J.J. Goldberg, his name is very similar to the book we've been talking about, part one and part four, by Eric Goldstein. This book, The Price of Whiteness: Jews, Race, and American Identity. And I'd like to take up the rest of this installment reading from and commenting on sections from that book. On page 19, the uses of race. Under the pressure of the shifting social boundaries of the 1870s, the language of race became an attractive vehicle for self-expression among American Jews and was used liberally in the weekly Jewish press, in popular novels and magazines, and in the pronouncements of Jewish leaders. The great appeal of racial language was its unique ability to capture the strong attachment of Jews to Jewish peoplehood, a feeling heightened during a time when many of the familiar markers of Jewishness were receding. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Just like what J.J. Goldberg is talking about in his article this week about the impending doom of the liberal Jews, the assimilating Jews. It's been happening forever, and it will continue to happen forever. Continuing here. Because Jews could no longer count on clear social boundaries to set them off from non-Jews, they looked to race as a transcendent means of understanding and expressing the ties that held them together as a group. Not really. They looked to race because that was actually a pretty good match for reality. In short, racial language helped them express their ongoing attachment to the social dimension of Jewishness, even as the social distinctiveness of Jews began to weaken. In similar fashion, by the way, just let me make the point here, if their distinctiveness was weakening, if their identity was weakening, then why are they strategizing to grasp onto race and to think of themselves as a race? It's because it's not the case. That's not why they grasped onto race. Race was the term that captured this idea of peoplehood. Peoplehood is a euphemism for race. Race is a euphemism or another word for this peoplehood that they talk about. And they've never abandoned that. They can't abandon that because that's the secret of their success. Their group cohesiveness is depends on them seeing themselves as a group. In a similar fashion, racial language also allowed Jews to maintain their self-image as a persecuted people, as they rose on the economic ladder and attained an unprecedented level of social acceptance. For Cyrus Schulzberger, editor of The American Hebrew, Jewish racial identity could not be understood apart from the history of Jewish oppression, which had deeply shaped the group's character and bound its members more closely together. The racial distinction between Semite and Aryan, and he writes that in quotes around Semite and Aryan, had been, quote, more clearly marked by the reason of the persecution which we have undergone, he explained. The story of those persecutions form us a peculiar legacy which stirs the blood and touches the heart of every Hebrew in a way that it can stir none else, unquote. Many Jewish commentators of the period developed this theme by arguing that Jews' experiences with persecution had imbued them with a heightened morality, a clearer sense of justice, and a greater appreciation for the suffering of others. While the, quote, Aryan has stood for pillage, unquote, editorialized the American Hebrew in 1884, the Semitic race has stood for peace. Well, let me just comment about this whole section here, that the opposition here that's being set up between whites and Aryans is the term of the early 20th century. Actually, both terms were in use, but they're pretty much synonyms. They're talking about the same group of people, whites and Aryans. And a distinct advantage to Aryan is that it excludes Jews, is that it's explicitly in opposition to the Semites. And that's why this Jewish author is writing little sneer quotes around Aryan and Semite, as if those things, those concepts don't really exist, in a text where he's actually describing how just 100 years ago, Jews not only accepted that it existed, but basically evangelized it, embraced it, the idea. And they use several different words for themselves, Jew, Semite, Hebrew, but again, like white and Aryan, these are just synonyms, and it really makes the contrast between the two groups stark. This section includes, beyond that, some other extraordinary admissions coming from Jews. This idea that the language of race was an attractive vehicle. They see it from a pragmatic point of view of, is it good for the Jews is not just a static evaluation. Is something good for the Jews, but does it serve the Jews, or can it be made to serve the Jews, is what comes through in this way of describing it as an attractive vehicle. Race is an attractive vehicle to capture the strong attachment of Jews to Jewish peoplehood. This idea that the Jews are dissolving is really just their way of describing themselves as victims, really what's an important part of their parasitism. This infiltration of other people's societies is what is actually going on when they're supposedly dissolving and disappearing and dying off. They're interbreeding with the population around them and creating people who are still tied to the Jews and are still interested in serving Jewish interests, and do it with a better disguise. Do it not openly as Jews, but in our case here, seemingly as white. We see, some double talk and double think here about this oppression and this view of themselves as oppressed, and the fact that they actually rule, the fact that they're very wealthy and powerful. And also this, you know, dissolution, this fear, this constant paranoia that they're dissolving, versus the reality that they're more unified than any other group as to who they are and arguing about and strategizing about their best interests, pursuing their best interests. We see that they embraced race. Not only did they embrace race 100 years ago, but they embraced this idea that the Aryans were a race and the Semites were a race that were distinct from each other and at odds with each other. They actually argued that the Jews were better than the Aryans. That's that business about the Aryans stood for pillage, the oppressors, and the Semitic race stood for peace, the poor victims of those Aryans. Back to Amanda Bynes's description of it today, 100 years later, that the Germans did something wrong by seeing what the Jews themselves have always seen, that they're separate, that they're different. And this is in contrast to what Goldstein was just writing a few pages earlier, we talked about the last time, when he sort of mocked the idea of Aryan and Semite as coming purely from philology, that the study of language, that it wasn't only from language, as I said the last time. He mentions here the language of suffering and persecution and impending dissolution. This has always been the attractive vehicle for Jews. It's the core of their identity, really. It's what holds them together. Beyond the, we're the Jews, well, what does it mean to be a Jew? Well, we're the oppressed people, the victims, is the next most important thing. It's the core. It's the most essential thing. And the other thing to keep in mind is that he's writing here, Goldstein, about a period of time that was before the National Socialists came to power in Germany. It was before Hitler even had formed the National Socialist Party and come to lead it anyway, and before World War II, before any Holocaust that they like to talk about. This idea of themselves as victims, as oppressed, as persecuted, long preceded the Holocaust, which is really just the latest and largest, most hammered on example that they use. But before that, they were still talking about themselves as victims, seeing themselves as victims. Yeah, and then there's this, it's surprising how frank he is in describing the connection between this mechanism, this tool that they use of talking about themselves as oppressed, how it holds them together, actually. It gives them the moral high ground in their own minds and enables them. And at the same time, it's breaking down opposition on the other side against them. But also how it serves to excuse their rising on the economic ladder, as he puts it, attaining unprecedented levels of social acceptance. He leaves out here financial success and power, political power. I have to read this part again. The story of those persecutions form us a peculiar legacy, which stirs the blood and touches the heart of every Hebrew in a way that can stir none else. This is the Jewish narrative. This section of text we're talking about here is how the Jewish narrative works, what it is and how it works. And at the heart of it is morality, this seeing themselves as the most important group, and the definition of what's good and what's evil is in terms of the Jews. And it gives them then the moral fortitude to do things to the people around them and feel justified in doing it. A little later on in the book, skipping over quite a bit here now, but in chapter 4, we'll skip ahead to what are we? Jewishness between race and religion on page 108, confronting Jewish racial origins. In defending endogamous marriage, that would be marriage to themselves within their group, and opposing the government's racial classification schemes, American Jews often relied on diversionary tactics. By trying to change the topic from race to religion, they aimed to protect their status as white Americans without having to directly deny their cherished, quote, racial affinities, unquote. As Simon Wolf's appearance before the Immigration Commission demonstrated, however, such tactics fell flat in the face of direct questions about Jewish racial identity. In the pages preceding this section here that I'm reading, he talks about Simon Wolf testifying in front of Congress. And this was in front of an Immigration Commission in 1909. And I thought that the international Jew, Henry Ford's international Jew, does a much better job telling it from a white point of view, that the evasiveness that Wolf used in trying to avoid the very direct questioning about this issue of as to exactly how to see Jews as a race or as a religion. And this double talk about race versus religion goes back to 100 years ago and beyond. It really, they flip back and forth to whichever one serves their interests better at the time. Continuing here. This was precisely the problem American Jews confronted as questions began to arise among scholars and scientists about Jewish racial origins. In clarifying their place in American life, Jews had to have a coherent explanation as to how they fit into the larger story of human racial development. Yet the story of Jewish origins, to which most Jews of the period subscribed, had significant potential to mark them as racial outsiders in white America. During the 19th century, the claim of, quote, Semitic, unquote, origin had become something of a badge of honor for American Jews, allowing them to trace their heritage back to the dawn of civilization and take credit for laying the ethical foundations of Western society. By the early 20th century, however, some Jews had become alarmed at the tendency of scientists, scholars, and popular commentators to attribute an African origin to the Semites. So they saw themselves and their Semitic origin as a badge of honor, but they became alarmed when they were actually seen as having more in common with blacks. And that's their response to this threat, this perceived threat to their infiltration and manipulation and exploitation of America, was to resort to diversionary tactics and lobbying in Congress and telling flat-out lies, flipping back and forth between race and religion as their identity. And that's what we're seeing laid out here in black and white in this book by Goldstein. Continuing on page 110, though the dedication to the story of Semitic origins remains strong among many Jews, Jewish leaders did not begin to see the importance of establishing their claim to whiteness scientifically. At the height of the controversy over immigration classification in 1909, Jewish notables exchanged letters. These are private letters here he's disclosing, expressing concern about the increasing reliance of government policy on the work of race scientists, whom they feared were dangerously close to pronouncing the Jews a non-white race. While they had confidence that they could continue to dispute the racial classification of Jews on a political level, they were less certain of their ability to contest the authoritative voice of racial science. As Cyrus Adler of the American Jewish Committee wrote to his colleague Meir Schulzberger, Jewish leaders needed to enlist the help of an anthropologist in order to get, quote, a very strongly worded declaration as to the practical identity of the white race, unquote. One that would presumably leave no doubt as to the whiteness of Jews. This is the manipulation in action here. Now here they face, they're kind of between a rock and a hard place. The hard place is this racial classification that seems to be coming down the pipe toward them. And the rock is science. How can they overturn science? Well, they did in the end. And, I'll continue talking about that the next time. There's more to read from this book along the same lines here about this story. You know, the title of the book, I missed it the first time around when I was talking about this, the price of whiteness. What is the price of whiteness? This is just another lesson in Jewish mentality of how they see themselves and everything in terms of themselves. It implies that the Jews have paid in some way for their conspiracy against white Americans to infiltrate and manipulate and exploit white Americans. They haven't. The cost has been to white Americans. And that's the cost of mistaking the Jews as white. The Jews deliberately defrauded Americans.